Our next discussion is going to be about the state of contemporary conversion, especially in the wake of the tragedy and criminal conviction of Rabbi Barry Ferrandell in Washington, D.C. Again, I'm going to give a very limited introduction, and the issues should speak for themselves. I'd like to introduce our two panelists. On my left, Ms. Bethany Mandel, converted to Judaism under the auspices of the Washington Beit Din in 2011. After the arrest of her sponsoring rabbi, Barry Ferrandell, she penned a blog post on the Times of Israel website, which went viral. It was entitled, A Bill of Rights for Jewish Converts. She's become a leading voice on Orthodox conversion in the United States and was one of two converts on a committee that the Rabbinical Council of America formed in order to reevaluate conversion protocols and best practices following the Ferrandell scandal. She's a writer and a stay-at-home mother and was recently named one of the Forward 50. Rabbi Reuven Tradbergs is the director of the Israel Office of the Rabbinical Council of America, received his BA from Carleton and Smich from YU. He was an assistant rabbi at Young Israel of Staten Island, rabbi of Knesset Israel in Birmingham, before, of course, serving as a rabbi here in Toronto at Kilat Shari Torah from 1994. Him and his wife Joyce made Aliyah in 2009. Rabbi Tradbergs was one of the point people coordinating the creation and implementation of the RCA's new conversion protocols. Please welcome our panelists. Everybody stated they want to be on first name here, so that's how it's going to go. Bethany, you've become well known, understandably, because you were one of the victims of Rabbi Ferrandell. But in reading your convert's Bill of Rights, what struck me was your powerful articulation of the serious problems in the conversion process, both in terms of the rabbinate and the Orthodox community at large, separate from and even prior to Rabbi Ferrandell's criminal acts. So I'd like you to describe for us what you perceive and experienced as the crucial problems in the contemporary Orthodox conversion process, and also what you see as the most fundamental alterations that need to occur.
So I wrote this piece probably about a week after Barry Ferrandell's arrest, and it basically had nothing to do with him. I had always sort of carried a lot of, I guess the word is bitterness, even though I don't really see myself as a bitter person, about what happened in my experience, and but I never, he unsurprisingly, sort of in retrospect, was a really manipulative person. So I had sort of always had this blog post written in my head, but I never wanted to click post because in 20 years, if my daughter's getting married and the Masada Kedushin calls him to say, you know, is this a kosher conversion? I was sort of always afraid that he would be like, you know, I don't know how sincere she was at the time because I had written a blog post 20 years prior. So I was always afraid. I mean, it's like this is one of the fundamental problems is that even after you're done, even after you go to the mikveh, you're never really safe. And I definitely felt that way with Barry, who I don't call rabbi anymore. So after his arrest, I was sort of, my first response was, wow. And then it was, oh gosh, that's it for my conversion. And it's sort of funny that I went to him because he was the gold standard of conversion. And then it turned out that he was like the worst possible person to convert with in the United States. Little did I know at the time. And so I wrote this piece basically saying, like, these were the issues that I have had, these are the issues that my friends have had. And a lot of them sort of stem from a fundamental disrespect of converts and of their time and of their personhood. So, like, during the process, the thing that was so frustrating for me, and I think for most other people, is that there's no timeline. So you approach a rabbi and you say, you know, I'd like to convert. And they never, in my experience, said, okay, these are the things you have to learn. Let's keep on touching base to make sure that you're staying on a curriculum and that you're going on track. And then when you're done, that's it. So I went to him the first time and I said, okay, I've read your entire reading list already. And he said, he quizzed me and he said, okay, if the Besdin was today, you would pass. But you happen to be dating a guy and I don't want to make it look like you're having like a quickie conversion for marriage. So I'm going to hold you. And he held me for, I think, 10 or 11 months, which doesn't sound so long now. That's how long conversion should take. But when you're asking every single week, what's going on? How can I, like, just give me something. I have to sign a lease. I have to give my job notice. I need to plan my life. And I wasn't able to do that. And that's I think, the biggest frustration for people. And it's also, it's very hard to find someone who will work with you because conversion, unfortunately, has become so politicized that rabbis don't want to deal with it. So I approached, probably five or six rabbis before Barry Freindel said, okay, I'll work with you. And I still today am grateful that he at least did that. And so that I think was really frustrating. And I think for me also it was, conversion was very painful because my father was Jewish and I was raised Jewish and I didn't know I wasn't Jewish until a birthright trip when I was 19. I didn't know about the matrilineal situation. Well, I did know, but then I approached a Reform rabbi who was my rabbi, and she said, oh, nobody does that anymore. Don't worry about it. You're good. so that was when I was probably 16. And then I found out when I was 19, like, oh, people still do that. That's still a thing. So every time I sort of approached a rabbi, and I was sort of treated like I was just like the shiksa who met a guy in a bar. And I didn't just meet a guy at a bar. I wanted to marry a Jewish man, and I didn't. I wasn't willing to not. And so there was always sort of this. There was a lot of pain around the fact that, like, one of the most fundamental parts of my identity was never really recognized by the religious leaders, who I was trying to sort of right this wrong. I had experienced a lot of anti-Semitism growing up. I was the only Jewish kid in my town, and kids would throw quarters at me because they were heavier. And a girl said to me, you know, Hitler didn't finish his job. She started the taunting with, like, do you like ovens? I heard your people like ovens. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then she said, well, you know, Hitler didn't finish his job. And I was like 6th, 7th grade. I was pretty young. And I spit in her face. She called the principal on me, and it was like this whole big scandal in my school of, I think there was like 90 kids in my class. And these are
sorry, for the record, where did you grow up?
Rochester, New York. Very, very rural Rochester. So that was sort of like where I was coming from. I was coming from being raised Jewish and dealing with a lot of anti-Semitism and then finding out like it was all for nothing. It wasn't even Jewish after all that. So that sort of experience of having a Jewish identity in some capacity is actually a surprising trend among Orthodox converts. A lot of people do have a Jewish identity in some fashion. So I think there was a disrespect of my sort of my personal sort of journey. And there's also, I mean, thank God it wasn't for me, but there's a disrespect of financial situations. So there was a lot of bullying into, not for me, thank God, but for a lot of friends, doing mandatory tutoring that costs hundreds or thousands of dollars and that you're not made aware of initially. So that's a definite problem. And then also sort of a disrespect of what you have to go through in order to convert. It's not just keeping Shabbos, but it's saying to your best friend, I can't come to your wedding. And how do you maintain that friendship? And how do you maintain a relationship with your family when your grandmother's funeral is on Erev Sukkos, or I think it was Shavuos, that was my grandmother. It was Erev Shavuos on Long Island, and I lived in New Jersey, and I couldn't make it. And my in-laws offered, and they couldn't make it. And like, how do you explain to your family, your Catholic family, you know, I can't come because it's a Catholic mass, and I can't come because it's Erev Shavuos, and, you know, sorry. Like, how do you? And there was never, when I would ask sort of questions of rabbis, and this was after the fact, it's like, sorry, you can't go. Stum, that's it. And there was never like, how can we make this happen with your family? Like, how can you not be ostracized from your family after this? How can we sort of make this okay? And so there was like sort of there was not, before and afterwards, there wasn't really an understanding when I would ask a Shiloh like that, what getting the answer no meant. And then afterwards, also there's, I mean, the thing that, that's why I asked you if this was being taped. The thing that led me to write the Times of Israel piece actually wasn't really Barry Freindel's arrest. It was probably 3 weeks before, my husband and I, with a $1,000 check, which is not easy for us, let me tell you, tried to join a shul in our area. And my husband was schmoozed for 20, 30 minutes. He has a lot of familial connections, including his brother and sister are both on the board of the shul. And he was schmoozed. And then the rabbi looked at me and said, I'm going to need to see your paperwork. And I was like, oh, okay. I guess I can get that for you. And so he sort of said, okay, why did you convert? And I said, that's a really personal question to start off with. Like my husband was schmooze, like, oh, how are your parents? Da, da, da. And then it's like, hi, I'd like to ask you one of the most personal questions, and I've never really spoken to you before. And then he said, oh, so where do your parents live? And I said, did you read the application after the convert part? Because I listed my parents' yard site states. So he stopped reading once he hit the check mark I had converted. So that was already sort of like a slap in the face. And then Barry was arrested, and I had sent him my paperwork, and Barry was arrested, and he never reached out and said, how you doing? That must have been really painful. How can we make coming to shul easier for you? How can we make going to the mikveh easier for you? What can we do? And I became like a very sort of public victim, not really by my choosing. I was outed by a reporter. And I didn't hear from anyone in my community that was like a rabbinic leader. How you doing? How can we help you? And so I was sort of like, I'm never going to be good enough. I'm never going to be Jewish enough. This is like, after all of that, and then on top of being filmed on the day I converted, it's never going to be enough. I'm never going to be Jewish enough. And I was really angry. And so I wrote this blog post at 2 a.m. on my phone. And I put it on the Times of Israel at 6 a.m. as my husband was walking out the door. And I said, nobody's going to read it. Don't worry about it. I just sort of, my catharsis, need to get it out there. And then it was shared. I think by the time he sat down at his desk, he opened the Times of Israel newsletter. And it was the first thing on the Times of Israel newsletter. And then he went to the website, and it was top above the fold. And it had been shared that by that point like 7,000 times or something. And it had been shared, it has been shared total 15,000 times. So God knows how many times it's been read. And I keep on apologizing to my husband about it. I'm like, I really didn't think anyone would read this. I'm really sorry. Because he didn't, he should have had a say, and he didn't really, unfortunately. But it's just sort of to rewind. I think that a fundamental lack of respect for where we're coming from is really, and it's not just rabbis. I didn't hear from a lot of people in my community either. And after I wrote that piece saying, you know, it's hard to plan lifestyle events like a bris or a wedding. And then my son was born 3 months later, and I didn't get a call like, how's the bris planning going? So even me, who wrote this like very viral piece about how like converts need to be given help, that was like my personal also cry for like help. And I never got a call from anybody like, so how's the bris planning going? Like, how is this, like, are you feeling like you know what you're doing? Are you feeling like you know how to find a moil? Like, because me personally, like, a moil is, like, pretty a big deal. Like, he's cutting a really important part of my child's body. And I want to, like, vet that person. And so nobody sort of said, like, you know, I dealt with Rabbi so-and-so, and he was great, just so you know. Because maybe these are conversations people have. Maybe they don't. I don't know. Or do you people talk about, like, do you exchange notes on moils? I feel like you should.
Sure.
And so, like, those sorts of things, like, were never, like, sort of broached as a conversation to me. So I was, like, sort of the weirdo posting, like, on the Facebook group in my community, like, so what do you think about Rabbi so-and-so? Let me know. Hit me a private message. And that's just sort of, but I was, like, willing to be that chutzpah dick because it's my son and, you know, want grandchildren one day, but yeah, so so that I think is the respect issue.
Right. I'm going to get back to you just for sort of fundamental alterations that you'd like to see in terms of suggestions. I just want to ask Reuven for a second. You were a public rabbi for many years, and you've had first-hand knowledge of conversion and how it works. But were you surprised by some of the things that Bethany wrote, or did they ring true in your experience as well?
So just let me preface that. So I was the rabbi at Kilat Shari Torah here for 15 years. But for 10 years of the time that we were in Toronto here, I ran the Bet Din of the Vada Rabbanim of Toronto. I was the one that got all of the calls for conversion. Here in Toronto, there was kind of an agreement, not a written agreement, but there was a general agreement that all conversions in the Orthodox community were done through the Vada Rabbanim. It was one Bet Din for all the conversions. And I was the guy that got all of the calls, the initial calls for people interested in conversion. And then I ran the Bet Din for 10 years, during which time we completed 250 adult conversions and about 250 adoption conversions. I probably got 5,000 inquiries about conversion during that time. So I think I had a lot of experience in conversion. I was the guy that met with the people for their initial interview. I was the one that they called when they wanted an appointment with the Bet Din, and I would talk, you know, how are you doing, where are you up to? The rabbis that were working with the people would call me and give me reports. So I thought I was pretty good at conversion. And so my initial reaction when I actually sent Bethany a note 2 minutes after I read the article, the posting on the Times of Israel, when I read the article, it actually, I often cry when I speak publicly. It made me very sad. I felt I was the guy in Toronto, and I didn't know what people felt like on the other side. How could I not know that when we had people's lives in their hands, that they felt so vulnerable, and they wanted to know, what's the timeline? You know, I felt so disappointed that, you know, we, the rabbis, who have people's lives in our hands, and I think I was pretty good. You know, we set up a good system, we had good support, we had good tutors, but I felt so disappointed that, why weren't we listening more carefully to the people on the other side to hear what people's experience was? How could someone write who knows a lot of converts? Bethany was not writing for herself. She was writing for experience that she heard from a lot of people. And she's writing that, you know, people feel vulnerable. They feel put down. They feel that the rabbis aren't respecting them as people. That here they're walking in. Bethany is a very competent, involved with Commentary magazine. We had professionals, doctors and lawyers, people walking in who are very highly educated, quality people, and we're treating them like they're little kids. You know, what's the bracha you make on a potato? And I'm not realizing from the other side how demeaning that feels for the person. We had a system also in the Bet Din that when a person would have a meeting with the Bet Din, and they would be asked all sorts of different questions, and they would walk out the door. So I had hired Millie Grossman, who's a wonderful, wonderful friend and woman who had converted herself, who she and I had a tag team. So when the meeting with the Bet Din was over after 20 minutes or half an hour, either she would walk out with the person or I would walk out the person. If I walked out, she would take the notes for the next meeting. Or if she walked out, I would take the notes for the next meeting. And we would tell the person what just happened. We want to tell you that the rabbis really liked you and it was excellent and you really impressed them and it was wonderful. And, you know, this is what they meant when they said, you know, what's going to happen by the next meeting. So I thought we were pretty good at that. But I just felt very similar to what we talked about last night, that there's such a gap between the rabbi sitting on this side of the table and the experience of the person on that side of the table. And that I thought we did a pretty good job on this side of the table, but we didn't understand enough of the inner turmoil and vulnerability and frustration and pain. Conversion should not be that way. It should be a collaborative effort to help a person become Jewish. It shouldn't be an adversarial thing where people feel put down. So, you know, so when Bethany wrote the thing, I don't know that I agreed with everything that she wrote in the thing, but you know, when you wrote the you don't know this, when you wrote that Bill of Rights article, so amongst the rabbinic Google groups, there was discussion about it, and one rabbi who sits on one of the Bati Din took your entire article and picked it apart line by line, saying how it wasn't true, and how the Bati Din were really very good at what they do, and picked it apart. And I thought to myself, that's exactly the problem. Now, whether what you felt was felt by everyone is one thing, but what you wrote was valid because you're writing what you feel. And if that's how you felt, how could anyone say that that's not correct? It is correct. It is what you feel. And if the rabbis are only concerned with whether they're doing their job accurately and correctly and not listening to the fact that even if they are doing their job well, but if you're reflecting these kind of feelings, then we have a big disconnect. And I think that's what I felt as soon as I wrote Bethany as soon as I read the article, because we had decided in the Rabbinical Council of America to do a review of the Bati Din, of our Bati Din. There are 12 of them. There were 2,000 conversions that had been done since the start of this system of Bati Din in whatever, 5 years. And we had received a lot of complaints. Not a lot, 10, 15, 20 complaints about various different aspects of the system. So they asked me if I would put together a committee to do a review of the conversion Bati Din. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't figure out how to put a committee together that would challenge prominent rabbis in how they were behaving on Bati Din. I couldn't figure out who's going to be on this committee to do this. So when the Freundel scandal happened, so that was a catalyst. We had to do this. We had to put together the committee right away. And when you wrote the article, so I immediately sent it to the people in the RCA, and we decided pretty much on the spot that you needed to be on this committee, partly because we certainly wanted to have the voice of a convert on the committee, but also because you weren't mincing your words, and someone has to say it like it is, and we need to open our ears and listen carefully. I think Bethany's article and her being on this committee of the RCA was somewhat of a watershed moment, I think, in the leadership of the RCA, that we felt, let's stop being on one side of the table and let's try and make conversion and many other things more collaborative. There's wisdom on the other side of the table that we have to hear, specifically from women as well. And I think it was a watershed moment.
I'm just going to turn to you in a sec. I just want to redirect for a second. I wonder if you can venture a guess in terms of answering your own question. You asked a rhetorical question, like, how could it be that we didn't see da da da? What do you think?
So I think the answer is that This is an image that I've shared with Elliot before. I think there's different ways that rabbis look at their job. There's what my son Yosef calls the gatekeepers of the halacha. In other words, that the rabbinic job is to be like the mounted police in uniform with, you know, the, what do they hold these days? I don't know what they hold.
The nightsticks,
and guard the Torah to make sure that it's kept properly. And so I think in conversion in particular, there's been an obsessive involvement in the halacha. Conversion needs to be with rabbis who ought to be judges. It needs to be with converts who accept all the mitzvahs of the Torah. And so there's been, we've been focusing only on the halacha, and that's our job to make sure that we guard, to make sure no one gets in who shouldn't get in, or no conversion is done that shouldn't be done. And we've totally neglected the personal process of what needs to be done because we want to make sure the halacha is delivered properly. And so I think that's what happens. I think the major batei din, and these are all very fine rabbis. They're all very sensitive people, but that's not been their focus. And this whole process has caused a different focus. And I think in Toronto that was the case too. I don't think we worried ourselves with whether this was the healthy process that you were going through, as much as to make sure that the halacha was kept in its purest fashion.
Bethany, Ruvain pointed out that when you wrote the post and other things that you've written, you're expressing your own feelings, but you're also representing a certain cross-section of quite a number of people that you've spoken to, that you've interacted with, who've converted as part of the Orthodox process. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think has been the impact of all of this for you and for the other converts you know in terms of your Judaism? In other words, in terms of your religious convictions, your feelings about Judaism, not to put too fine a point on it, is there disillusionment? Do some of you in retrospect even question your desire to convert given the circumstances that followed? And also, do you feel converts are just forgotten about once they convert?
So I asked this question to, so I administer, I'm the sort of moderator, even though I don't really moderate anything, of a Facebook group. It's secret, no one can see the group, no one can see what we say, no one can see the members. Unfortunately, that's a big concern for people because a lot of people are in the closet and nobody really, I mean, there's a woman I spoke to last week and her kids don't know she converted and her rabbi doesn't know she converted and she says she's a born Jew whenever she doesn't want to talk about it. Which, I mean, is sort of understandable when I joined a shul and that was my first interaction with my rabbi. So people don't want anyone to know that they're converts. There's a large number of people like that. So I think of the people that I know, which you sort of have to take what I'm saying with a little bit of a grain of salt, because a large number of the people who I know that converted with Barry Frindell. So we're sort of coming at the situation from much more negative perspective than a lot of people. Like if you had converted in Toronto, I'm sure you would probably feel a lot more positive. So I think that there's sort of three camps as far as I sort of see the people that I know. I think that there's people who are idealists, and I think I was that before this whole scandal broke. And everything is great and everything is awesome. And if you don't think everything is awesome, then you're like a terrible Jew and you should probably just shut your mouth and walk to the corner. So there's that sort of camp. There's the camp of like, I have really low expectations. So when these things happen, I just sort of shrug them off and like live my life. And that's sort of where I am now. And then there's the view, which is unfortunately very prevalent among Frindell's converts of, wow, I made a really big mistake. And I mean, I would say, I don't probably know like 15 or 20 people who were pretty open with each other. And I mean, especially the people that he filmed, there's the vast, vast majority are really disillusioned. And a number of people have stopped. Like when I sign back on Saturday night on Instagram or Facebook, I see a lot of their posts from 5 hours prior. And so I've sort of seen a lot of people been like, and people that are like married with children who married an Orthodox guy. And now there's a lot of, especially with the mikveh situation, there's a lot of conversations in these like private groups of his victims saying like, how do I stay married and don't go to mikveh anymore? Because this is a line in the sand for me and it's a line in the sand for him. And we have very different lines. So there's a lot of disillusionment. I think that this sort of scandal disillusioned people who didn't even have him as their conversion rabbi. So I know of a number of women who, especially, I mean, I think like what, 90% of converts are women or something crazy like that, of adults, who even after this scandal, and they had really nothing to do with him, were like, you know what, I'm done. I'm gonna go get a conservative conversion and just be done with this, because he was very prominent, and it was just sort of like the straw that broke a lot of people's backs. There was a couple women who I know who had dealt with sort of like gross situations with rabbis prior, and this was sort of like the biggest of the big head honchos of the conversion world, and he did this, and then after Tropper, and there's like, I said in my speech, so the RSA invited myself and the other convert on the panel, Evelyn, and I just want to say that I really respect you guys for also choosing Evelyn, because if you think I don't mince words, you've never met Evelyn. She's a tough cookie. She's a corporate lawyer. Like, she writes my really hard emails. She happens to be one of my best friends, and so whenever I have an email that I need to be like really strongly worded, but like be really nasty, but at the same time you walk away and you're like, she was really nice about it. Evelyn is the person that writes those emails for me. What was I saying? Yeah, right. Thank you. I lost my train of thought. Evelyn's awesome. And I forgot to send her a baby gift. That was where that train of thought went. We were invited by the RCA to be on this panel, and I spoke to a lot of people, and I was really like pretty sad and pretty surprised by how many people were just like wouldn't really talk to me about it because they had just sort of washed their hands of it. And a lot of our friends too. So I think that again, like, I'm sort of seeing this as a Frandell convert. So you sort of really do have to take it with a grain of salt, because I'm sure other people are much happier. And I think also the other grain of salt that you should take with what I'm saying is that people gravitate towards support groups when they need support. And when you're like happy with your life and everything's going swimmingly, like, Why join a Facebook group of other Orthodox converts if you really have nothing to say? So I think that that's sort of the other grain of salt that you have to sort of take. So a lot of the conversations in my group are predominantly negative. But I don't think that we necessarily represent all of Orthodox converts for those two reasons.
You know, Bethany, you mentioned the mikveh. I'd like you to both comment actually on the, obviously what Rabbi Freundel did exacerbated, brought to light sort of the potential corruption of the mikveh process at its very worst. But I think there were many people who argued in the aftermath that maybe there's something inherently wrong with the process in the first place. I'm wondering if either of you can comment on that notion, the idea, for instance, that the mikveh conversion process is inherently voyeuristic for females because, you know, even without an egregious violation of your privacy, which was obviously entailed in Rabbi Freundel filming you, is the very fact that under ordinary circumstances a Beit Din has the right to view the woman in the mikveh somehow a violation of appropriate sensitivities, let's put it that way?
So two things on that. Three things. First of all, halacha is halacha, and I think this was looked at by the post game, and there's not a lot of wiggle room. So that's just sort of like one of the things you just have to deal with. Sorry. Second, I was actually, even in the wake, so we did a survey on our panel of a very large number of people who converted in the RSA system, and that we were actually, even in spite of sort of 2020 vision, I was surprised by how many people didn't really respond negatively to that aspect of their conversion. There was a lot of people who said, you know, it was okay. And I felt that way, and I still feel that way. And it's sort of funny. One of the things that that Barry was known for doing in the week of all of everything that happened after he was arrested was it came to light that he was doing something called a practice dunk. And people, a very frustrating response to that that I got from a shocking number of people. How did you not know any better? Of course that has no basis in halacha. Like, how was I supposed to know any better? This is my conversion rabbi who wrote the RCA standards. Who am I to question him? But outside of that, so it was called a practice dunk because you'd go to the mikvah and it was a practice. And you'd go and you'd sort of get, you'd get ready and you'd dip in the mikvah and you'd sort of get a sense of what that day was going to be like. And it was weird. And I remember the clock being on the sink. And I almost played with it too. This is like, nobody, I tell this story to all the reporters and nobody writes about it. I think it's a really good story. I was sitting there and I get very antsy when I don't have my cell phone. And so I had no service and I was like, what do I do in here for like 20 minutes in this bath? Like I'm not now since becoming a mother, I'm fine in the bath for 20 minutes without my cell phone. But like at the time I was like, oh my God, what do I do? Like, I'm just going to sit here and not do anything. And so he was sitting outside the door because he had to come in and get the clock and then get the SD drive afterwards, but I had no way of knowing that at the time. And so I was sitting there, I was like, I really just like want to play music. But then would he like judge my choice of music? Would it be like not sneeze enough music? Like what would I choose? Would I choose talk radio? I think Rush is on right now. Oh, but I don't know if Rush is on right now. Is he conservative? Would he hate me because I'm conservative, because I'm listening to Rush Limbaugh? Maybe I should listen to something. And so like all of these things are running through my mind. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just not gonna play with the clock radio. And so I think about that moment all the time. Like, what if I had just listened to Rush Limbaugh? Would I have found the SD drive? So it's just like sort of a sidebar. But the practice dunk was actually really useful for me because part of what they did was they said, okay, come to the back of the room, come to this back corner. What do you see in the mikvah? And I said, pretty much nothing. And they said, okay, so when you convert, they're going to walk in and they're going to face the wall. And then they're going to line up in the back of the back corner of the room. And this is their view of you. So just so you know, this is what they're going to see. And they saw pretty much nothing. They saw like the top of my head. I'm 5'1". They saw the top of my head. And so I was never really uncomfortable. And it was sort of valid. He gave the excuse of why he was doing the practice dunks because women would get really nervous during it because the acoustics in the mic room weren't so great. And so they would ask you questions. And there was a woman, and this is true, and this was his reason for telling people to do the practice dunk. There was a woman who was like, what'd you say? And then turned around. And she was not 5'1". And they got a view. And so it was very uncomfortable. It was very uncomfortable for a very long time. Everyone in the room knew that they saw her naked. And it was like this really awkward thing. And so he said, I'm going to do this practice dunk now so that like when you're in the mikvah, you're like not gonna turn around. You're not gonna turn around. And so he like sort of drilled that into the mikvah lady at your practice dunk. Don't let her turn around. Talk to her in there. Ask her weird questions. And like, don't, like it's an impulse to turn when someone's talking to you. And so I actually found the practice dunk quite helpful. And now no one will ever do it again because you're gonna think that like there's a camera in the mikvah. But I mean, I don't think that it is inherently voyeuristic. And I there's not much to do about it.
Right, I hear you. It's a generational quirk, but when you said, should I play Rush? I was thinking of the Canadian rock band Rush, who I love. I thought to myself, that's a great thing to play in the mix, because I love Rush, okay? And it turns out you're talking about Rush Limbaugh, who I can't stand. You know?
I was like, would he hate me?
You know, Tom Sawyer, yeah, that'd be good.
Anyway, let me just make a comment about the mikveh and how it's done. May not have been clear. So the one of the aspects of conversion is that a person has to go into the mikveh and their head has to go underneath the water, and that's the moment of conversion. And the bet din needs to view that particular moment. So when it's a woman, the way we did it here in Toronto is the woman would go into the water. She'd have her back to the door There's a waiting room at the Chabad mikveh up in Thornhill. There's a room beside the actual mikveh room. We'd open the door. The rabbis would be standing in the other room, but able to look in. There were railings around the mikveh. We would put a sheet around the railings, and so that where you stood, when you opened the door, the angle was such that all you saw was the woman's head, and then you'd see the head disappear and come up. And the woman who worked with us, Millie, would stand at the spot and say to the woman, okay, move back a little bit, stand right there, and face the other direction. So that's the way it was done. But nonetheless, the woman is standing naked in the water, and three rabbis are, 8 feet away, looking through the door at her. So what Bethany mentioned was, as a result of Bethany's article and other articles, when we started this conversion review, we said, okay, we have these opinions, but are they are these unique opinions about conversion, or are these consistent with what other people feel as well? So let's do a survey of converts who have gone through the RCA program. So we sent the survey we hired a professional, to 800 different people who had gone through the conversion, and we got responses from over 400. That was a lot of people. And as Bethany mentioned, most of the adult conversions, the children is different, but most of the adult conversions were women, well over 80%. So one of the questions we asked was, describe to us your feelings about the mikveh experience itself. Did you feel okay? Did you feel it was a spiritual moment? Did you feel uncomfortable? Did you feel resentful? Did you feel angry? How did you feel about the fact that you were standing in front of rabbis naked in the mikveh? And that was what was surprising to us, is that very, very few people, I don't remember the exact numbers.
It was in the single digits.
Yeah, single digits out of 400 people, most of whom were women. So let's say 350. That was surprising, that very, very few felt resentful and that it was inappropriate and exposed and the like. So that was an interesting thing in that. And so as part of the review, we did go back to the halachic authorities of the RCA and pushed them a little bit on this and said, is there a way that this mikveh can be done and the rabbis not be in the room or not be visible? Can they stand in the next room with the door slightly ajar, hear the water splash, hear the mikveh lady say kosher, that she's gone under the water, and have that be sufficient? And they felt that they could not allow that to. So what some of the mikvehs do is they have the woman puts on a robe, a light fitting, a cotton robe or something, and she actually wears a robe at the moment in which she goes under the water, so that she is completely covered, but the water, it's porous, so the water is touching her skin. And that's what we recommend now for all of the mikvahs, is that the woman actually wear a robe when she's in the water and she has her back to the rabbis. And that's, I think, a better system.
You know, Bethany, a number of times you've said, both in print and here, what did I know? How could I have known? And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about whether you feel the situation with Barry Freundel was avoidable, in that there were sufficient warning signs in place, or is the bottom line that as awful and tragic as it turned out, and no one really could have been expected to know what he was up to?
So from what I knew of him, it was a 100% shock. Since all of this has happened, I've heard from a lot of people, including really, really close friends of mine. And one woman who's a very good friend of mine told me he would stop by her house late at night and ask to watch movies with her alone on her couch. That's a pretty big warning sign, I think. But she was afraid to tell anyone, and she didn't know who to tell, and so she never told anyone until afterwards. And there were a number of other stories like that. The stories that were reported were reported to different people. They were reported to Kesher, the synagogue. They were reported to individuals in the community. They were reported to the RCA. And I think that every sort of individual component of that sort of puzzle, it's sort of like 9/11, like everyone sort of had a little piece of information and no one shared that information. So the information that the RCA had, and the information that individual board members had, and the information that Kesher as a entity had, were not sufficient really to do anything but be like, you're being kind of weird, and you might want to stop being weird. But when all of those, if everyone had sat down and exchanged notes, there were very clear warning signs. If you had exchanged notes, no one was exchanging notes about a rabbi who had been on the pulpit for 30 years in Washington, D.C. I mean, there's this sort of question of, could it be avoided again? I think personally that there needs to be a body outside of the RCA. I think there should be a third person sort of, it was sort of bizarre. When I came, I didn't think to bring a book or a magazine and my antsiness again. I can't just sit on a plane for an hour and a half. So I happen to have a book on my Kindle, which I had on my phone, and it was a review of the Catholic scandals of the sex scandals in the 80s, and I was like, oh, this is sort of a funny thing to read on my way to Toronto for this panel. And so I read it, and I was like, sort of what I found really interesting of what they sort of did in the aftermath was they made a separate entity to take reports, and they weren't tied to the Vatican, and it wasn't tied to a diocese. And sort of like the nice thing and the not nice thing about Judaism is that there's no real centralization. But I wish that there was something like that. And if there had been somewhere where the RCA could have sent their notes, and if Kesher could have sent their notes, and if these women who had really problematic interactions with him could have said, you know, and we sort of talked about doing this for the conversion committee, but sort of just an overarching sort of body to take these sorts of complaints. And they did it because they did a cost-benefit analysis of the lawsuits. And they were like, we're probably going to go bankrupt if we don't tackle this situation. A lot of what they described in the book was sort of like a crazy parallel to sort of what we're facing now. The Vatican was most concerned when these scandals first started breaking in the early 1980s, they were most concerned about this theological break between the liberalization and the conservatization, and everything was going a little bit too far to the left, and so there was a lot of pushback, and there was all of these like sort of like internal fights over like Rabbi Avi Weiss versus the RCA, and I was sort of like, oh, this is exactly what we're doing now. Like we're spending all of our energy on this Mishigas. Meanwhile, like we're fiddling while Rome burns, basically, which I think you mentioned, like, yeah. that sort of, I wish that there had been, and that there is a way to report things like this.
I had asked Bethany in an email, like, why do you think it is that Orthodox groups sometimes just don't get it, why they fiddle while Judaism burns? And I guess since you've raised it, I'm wondering what you think can be done to alter that.
You know, I don't know. With this latest RCA sort of the statement that was made about women being ordained, and then the pushback from the left wing of Open Orthodoxy, I don't care. Like, I don't care about any of these issues at the end of the day. Like, I think personally it's nice to have a woman to talk to, especially in the wake of all of these things, but like, I don't care what she's called. And like, maybe that's me because I'm not in school to become a Maharat, so therefore I don't care. But like, let Open Orthodox do their thing and let them call whomever they want, whatever they want, and it's their business, and let the right wing recognize that or not recognize that. But the back and forth fights have like really destroyed my sense of like love and respect for the Jewish authority community. Because there's so many issues that we should be tackling. And instead it's just like, let's make a protest song about the RCA. And I'm like, where's the protest songs about like kids being molested? Like what is this really the issue that like should be keeping us up at night and like turning Jews against each other? And I went to a dinner for the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance, JOFA, and this woman approached me because I wrote something like this for the Times of Israel, and I sort of knew that it was probably a good thing to write because everybody hated it on the right and the left. And everyone was like, we felt like you were talking about us. I'm like, because I was. And she said, you know, if we don't push back against this, then our more right-wing family members won't eat by us because they don't see us as Orthodox. And I was sort of like, then don't eat by them. Like, if they don't see you as Orthodox, and if they're sort of seeing, like, these, like, ridiculous rabbinic statements back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, like, if this is affecting your familial relationships, then you have problems in your family. Like, that's not because of the rabbis. That's because, like, you guys have issues and you might want to work them out. And so I would really love it to stop, but I'm like sort of, it gets clicks, and it gets like, and it's fun to get angry, and it's fun to like, right. It's unfortunate.
Ruvaina, I want to go back to the committee that you were part of and the kinds of things that they set up in place in the wake of the situation, especially given your reminiscences about what it was like to be, the gatekeeper for conversion in Toronto and your subsequent emotions when you read Bethany's piece. What do you think is the most important feedback you received in the RCA protocol, the converts who replied to your survey, and what are the panel's chief findings, and what kind of changes do you think you need to make?
I think that, we sent out this, we formed this committee to do a review of all of the conversion Bati Din. And Bethany was on the committee, along with Evelyn Fruchter. I will say, after we had met in this committee, we had this committee meeting with 10 or 11 people. We would meet every Wednesday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I live in Israel. So I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I got dressed. I did get dressed. I didn't do it in my pajamas. I got dressed, had a coffee. And at 4:30 in the morning, I got on these conference calls, and we had a lot of them. There was about 3 or 4 months every week. So we decided we would do this survey, and we got the results back. And then we worked on making recommendations. So I think one of the biggest things that came out of it was what I mentioned before, to try and help Dayanim, the judges on the various Bati Din, have more exposure to what the experience is emotionally and interpersonally of the convert through the process. We weren't dealing with the halachic process, we weren't dealing with those things, but the interpersonal process, because the feeling we had was we're actually not involved in a conversion court, we're involved in Jews. Well, they need to convert first, but they're going to be Jews the rest of their life. And we want to have healthy Jews the rest of their life. So these 2,000 people who have converted are now Jews living as Jews in communities, and we want them to have healthy respect for rabbis, we want them to love Judaism, and we want them to be productive and positive members of the community. So if in the course of conversion they're angry and resentful, then we have to deal with that. So I think part of the biggest thing that I think we realized was that we're not running courts, we're running conversion processes. And that involves the person's emotional and spiritual development. And in particular, one of the surprises I think that came out for me was the feeling, the post-conversion fumble. The fact that we the job was over once the conversion was done, and then we had no more involvement with the converts, and yet many of the people, as Bethany mentioned, you know, this idea of having your papers checked, You know, I just tell you personally, it never occurred to me how hurtful a thing that is, and actually how inappropriate it is. If you're walking in with your husband, and you are married by an Orthodox rabbi, and you're applying now for a synagogue, why actually does that rabbi need to see your papers? You know, why does he need that? And I would ask people for their conversion papers too, when they would come to join our shul. And I never realized that that would be, and it's like, I've done this already. I'm through this thing. You know, it was 10 years ago. I don't need to go through this again. So I think there were things post-conversion in the experience of the convert which we just were neglectful of. We didn't think of those things. So some of the recommendations that came out of the, we wrote a 20-page list of recommendations. One of the major things were to sensitize the rabbis who sit on the conversion Bati Din as to what the experience is on the other side, and also to realize that we have some community education and some general education to do in the Orthodox world to sensitize people to the experience of converts as time goes on. But you mentioned also, Bethany, that, you know, as you have this child, so for you, this is the first time you're dealing with, you know, a moil, and like, what's that about? That's just something that never occurred to me. It just never occurred to me that, how would we figure out, how do we navigate this? I don't remember in particular, in my own experience, if I forgot to help people through that process, but it's not something you think of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
it would be the same for a bar mitzvah and a wedding and mm-hmm. everything.
Yeah, yeah. With my son's bris, I was sort of like, what do I do? And I also, so my dad was Jewish, so the family that I really am close with is Jewish, and sort of trying to figure out how to involve them in inappropriate ways. And also just, there's these questions that you ask your mom, and especially as a woman, and you don't have a mom who is a Jew. And so like at every sort of life cycle moment I come to, and the most recent one being my son's bris, because he's only 8 months old, sort of thinking of like, how does this work? Like how, and I don't want to stick it on my mother-in-law. And I also just we're very different people. And so I didn't want her planning my wedding, for example, because she wanted to have like a 400-person wedding in a big hall in Lakewood. And that's not me. And so like sort of butting heads with her a little bit, because she wanted everything to be really nice. And I wanted like a barbecue in the backyard. And how do you like, so I was sort of flying blind a little bit.
You end up with a barbecue in Lakewood? Is that?
And we did, yeah. Yeah, after a lot of fighting. A kosher, of course, come on. And so my mother-in-law chose like the best caterer, and like we had steak and also hot dogs, but nice. But like trying to sort of figure out like how to plan all of these like life cycle moments alone. And sort of like when you're a convert, me or anyone else who's sort of coming from nothing, like you have different needs. So they're not like things that rabbis are necessarily totally familiar with. So like when I talked to my son about Kedushin, which was like this like Lakewood guy, he had like a very long white beard, and he like made assumptions like I couldn't read or speak Hebrew, and then I could. And he was like, oh, that's so great. I'm like, that was really condescending. but he tried to be like really encouraging, and I just sort of took it as condescending. My sort of like inherent fear of rabbis, because I had just come off a conversion process where I was scared of my rabbi, I wanted my family to be part of my wedding. And so how can my like, can my non-Jewish stepfather walk me down the aisle? Does he have to wear a kippah? He's really weird about it. And like sort of all of these questions that the rabbi, it never occurred to him to say like, okay, so who are the family members that you want to include in your wedding? is this one Jewish? Is this one not Jewish? Is this one Shomer Shabbos? Okay, so how do we make sure that your family is represented at this wedding? Because when my mother-in-law was planning it, she didn't really know me very well. She didn't know my family at all. She had never met any of my members of my family. So she was planning it, and she was just sort of like, okay, we'll give this Sheva Brachot to Uncle Richie, and we'll give this one to Pop, and we'll give this one. And I was like, hey, it's my wedding. Like, can my family do some of the things? And so, like, sort of trying to figure out, like, how my non-Jewish and my Jewish family could be involved in my wedding. And it was sort of like me fighting and pushing. And, like, the rabbi was like, I don't know if that can, so let's just, like, and I was like, no, it's actually a really big deal to me if my stepfather walks me down the aisle. So look it up. Figure it out. I'm like, I'm not going to show up if you don't. And I said that a lot. I'm not going to show up. So we like eventually sort of came to an agreement. But there was like, I mean, I'm a pretty chutzpahdik sort of person, as you can tell. And I'm like a really outspoken person. And it was really sad to talk to a lot of my friends that are not as like, as me, and say like, I really wanted my dad to walk me down the aisle, but I was afraid of the rabbi, so I didn't really ask, and now my dad's really ticked off. And, like, doing the Sheva Brachot, like, I went to a friend's wedding, and they did them in her non-Jewish family did them in English afterwards. And I was like, you can do that? Oh, man, I really missed a moment where I should have included my non-Jewish family in that way, and I didn't know, because I never would have thought of that. So there's, like, those sort of moments where, like, rabbis aren't usually attuned to those things. And so, I mean, I think one really valuable thing that we could potentially do is like sort of come up with like, here's a guidebook. You have a convert in your community. Like if you're marrying them, here's different questions that might not occur to you. And things like that. And I'm like sort of like now learning like in retrospect, like all of these, like I didn't really know what a Shalom Zachar was. Like I sort of knew, but I didn't really ever go. And so when my daughter was born, we obviously didn't do one. And then when my son was born, we had one. And I was sort of like, that's really unfair to our daughter. Like she didn't get that. And so my husband and I were like fighting. He was like, I was like, I don't want to do a Shalom Zachar because Vera didn't get one, so Max doesn't get one. And he's like, well, that's not really how this works. And so I was like, okay, fine. But if we have another daughter, she's going to get one. And we're going to figure it out. And we're going to have a party. And I don't care if that's done because this is what we're going to do for our daughter. So it's like all of these sorts of whatever.
Let me just pick up on that.
If people want to ask a question, because we're coming near the end of the conversation, I suggest you line up at the mic now. Thank you.
I just want to mention about that. When the experience here in Toronto with conversion was that there's certain shuls that where the rabbis brought a lot of people for conversion, Eisha Torah and the outreach places, and you know that's the way it would work. The main, B'nai Torah, the Bayit, Shomer Shabbos, they just didn't really have many people coming for conversion because those are kind of Shomer Shabbos communities. But after the people would convert, then they would scatter to become members in all different types of shuls. So rabbis in shuls would not have a lot of experience with converts. They may only have one or two or three in the shul, in some of the shuls. And so this notion that when you meet with the couple before their wedding and you need to be sensitive to how they want their family to be involved, actually, for most rabbis, they don't have hardly any experience in doing that. So part of what we're planning for the follow-up to this conversion review is to provide manuals and things like that for the rabbis out in the field to be able to be more sensitive to these. We actually had a conversation with someone who's worried now, person who converted, about their son's bar mitzvah, which is quite a number of years from now, because they're already thinking, how is my non-Jewish family going to participate in my son's bar mitzvah? Mm-hmm. That's natural.
See, you and I should know something about this, though, right? Because we had a little, we're both, Ruven and I are both Bali Tshuva, right? So we had like a little smidgen of this, dealing with like non-Orthodox relatives, in my case, every single member of my family, both near and far, are not Dati, and you obviously, you know, have had a similar experience. So in some ways, we should have caught on to some of what that means to sort of have to negotiate all these like complex family dynamics in some ways. That's just a statement.
I'm better than a lot of other rabbis.
You are. Not,
you know, I think I have more sensitivity about that than others.
So let me just say, like, really, just like a hot second. The first time that you and I spoke, I cried afterwards. Like, to hear someone say it shouldn't have been that way, especially with my father being Jewish, I felt like I was crazy for years, like angry about my conversion process. And you validated pretty much like my big things. And to hear that, like, I'm not a crier. I am since my kids were born. I feel like they like broke me in that respect. But like, you personally, I don't know you. You seem very nice. but like, you.
I'm gonna tell my wife that.
Yeah, she's probably aware. But like, I told my husband afterwards, like, if every Bez Din could have operated like Toronto, like really minor things, like. You told me you would write a report of this is what happened at the Bez Din meeting and this is what needs to happen next. And all of the members of the Bez Din got it, and so did the convert. Like, that very small thing, I remember walking out of Bez Din meetings shaking, and I actually threw up in the bushes outside Kesha once. I'm like a very ajdi person, which is why I haven't eaten yet. I would walk out and I was like, what just happened? Oh my God, I feel like I'm dying. And I didn't eat for like a day afterwards. And when you told me like, oh yeah, we provide just like a paper with like, this is what happened. And even though I was sitting right there, like I couldn't tell you what happened in any of my best in meetings, but I do have one memory of them being really frustrating because they'd ask me the same questions over and over and over. So who are you and why you want to convert? Like, and it was my third meeting and I'd been doing this process for a year. And it's like, do we really have to have this conversation again? And you didn't have those conversations over and over and over. And you respected the fact that like, you only have 20 or 30 minutes and you want to get the most out of it possible. And you didn't repeat conversations. And I like those very small things shockingly don't happen in a lot of different Bez Dins across the country. If my conversion rabbi had been him, I probably wouldn't be sitting here right now. Let me just say that.
Thank you. So in a certain way, it's good he wasn't. Because we wouldn't have gotten to hear from you. Got one question from the floor.
Normally, I don't have problem to ask questions, but this time I thought twice because it will not be politically correct in this atmosphere. Just being so young and even younger as a Jew, and you already know what is best for Judaism and how it has to be changed, I am speechless.
I thought you were going to be like, well, that's really chutzpahdik. Yeah. That's what my husband says.
Quickly. First of all, I'd like to thank Bethany for being so forthright, and sometimes you need outside view. I'd like to ask Rabbi Trabergs, and one of the issues, obviously, with conversion is like the fact that it should be final, and it seems like you can repeatedly hear anecdotes that it's not final, and that's questioned when it comes later to Israel. Is there anything that can be done with respect to that?
That's a good question. Part of the motivation for having a centralized system of conversion in the RCA was to avoid that, so that if a person goes through those particular Bati Din, once they're through, then those would be universally accepted. You know, I hope that's true. So one thing that they tried to do in Israel in the previous government, Eli Ben-Dahan, when he was the Saradatot, or the Skan Saradatot, the Minister of Religious Affairs, he wanted to take all of the Rabbanut's records and digitize them so that every ketubah and every conversion and every bris would be recorded in the rabbinic database. The reason he wanted to do that was that if a person walks in to get registered for marriage and they put in their Tudat Zehut, and they write in their identity number, the computer would give you a green light or a yellow light. In other words, any previous conversion would never be revisited. Any person who had been married in the Rabbanut would never be suspected for their Jewish status. He wanted to take all of those questioning out of the hands of the registrars and say, whoever has converted, their status is non-questioned. No one even knows about it because you get a green light. It says the conversion was done by the Rabbanut, you got a green light. That may still be done in Israel, but the issue is an issue of revisiting. I hope that the RCA system avoids that by having it be more centralized, that everyone will accept the conversions in the future.
So two quick anecdotes to wrap up. First of all, when you posted your post, my wife read it first, I think like almost instantly, because it said like up like 7 minutes or something, and then she said, and she gave me a big elbow, and she said, oh, you gotta read this. And I read it, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I just want you to know, I know that you say, you know, you were hesitant to send it, and it kind of may have been an impulse thing, but no, I don't think that way at all. I think this is actually a very articulate, very important piece of contemporary Jewish writing, I really do. And I think it's must reading for all of you here to go out and read Bethany's piece and your subsequent pieces, which I've all followed on the forward and elsewhere. So that's A. B, just a little anecdote. So Reuven and I learn every morning in Jerusalem when we're not traveling at 9 o'clock in the morning. We have a Chavruta and Talmud each day. And there are many days that Reuven will come and I'll know that he'll say, I've been, you know, I had this like 4:30 meeting thing, but I want you to know that when 9 o'clock hits, he's alive, he's awake, and he is smoking. So that's a tribute to him as well. I think it's been a fascinating conversation, and I want to really thank our two panelists, and please give them a warm hand.